Often as a speaker, you're looking for when the hymns picked before kind of go along with what you're going to talk about. That didn't quite happen today, but they're related. You know, the hard thing about being a Christian is seeing all the things that God has given us and holding that in our mind. It's easy to look at a piece of something, to get excited and have that joy about the coming of the Lord. But in the song, Waiting and Watching, we're instructed to do that. But there's also the working. And you have to have both. And that one song, oft mixed with trial, grief, and pain, look up, he'll surely come for thee. The return of the Lord, when we no longer have to be here, it is a relief. We're done. But that trial, grief, and pain, that's what we're going to look at today. It's still the plan of God. It's not a mistake. He's not powerless to save you from it. It's in your life for a reason. Yes, events of the world are moving on. He will not tarry not. But people thought that the day after he left. It's been 2,000 years. It could be one day, 100 days, 10,000 years. We have the promise, the blessed hope of his return, of being with him, however it happens. But we also have the working, the grief, the pain of this life, that it's still in his plan. All the evil, the working of the devil, we do not dispute that, but it's still his plan. Psalm 115, in verse 1. Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory, because of your loving kindness, because of your truth and faithfulness. Why should the nations say, where now is their God? But our God is in heaven, and he does whatever he pleases. The idols are silver and gold, the work of man's hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. They have eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. They have noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but they cannot feel. They have feet, but they cannot walk. Nor can they make a sound with their throats. Those who make them will become like them, everyone who trusts in them. Where now is their God? Our God is in heaven, and he does whatever he pleases. Job chapter 1. And verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God, and abstained from all, and turned away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. He also possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very great number of servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. His sons used to go and feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send word and invite their sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of their feasting were over, Job would send and consecrate them, rising early in the morning, offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Job did this at all times. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming around on the earth, from walking on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered and reflected on my servant Job? For there is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright, one who fears God and abstains from and turns away from evil." Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will simply surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that Job has is in your power, only do not put your hand on the man himself." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. And we know what follows next. All the possessions, all his family except for his wife, is destroyed and taken away from him. Chapter 2 and verse 1, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming around on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered and reflected my servant Job? For there is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright, one who fears God and abstains from and turns away from evil. Yet still he maintains and holds tightly to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." Satan answered the Lord, "Skin for skin, yes, a man will give all he has for his life. But put forth your hand now and touch his bones and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome boils and agonizing, painful sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. You know, I think one of the hardest things, this has been said many times, for the believer to try to explain is why there is suffering in the world if God is so good. That's our message, that God is so good, right? And it's even more difficult, and I would argue impossible, to explain to the unbeliever how that suffering is not just a remnant of sin, something that man caused, but it falls into the purview of God's plan. In this story, it's not that God was powerless to stop Satan. He suggests it. Take all that he has, see what happens. Take his health, see what happens. Now, for the rest of it, Job's sitting there trying to understand, why is this happening to me? I've done nothing wrong. It's the picture that God wants for us. So often, I think we look at Job and say, oh, there's so much comfort there because I can relate to an illness or an injury or some tragedy in my life. The story of Job is not about things that go wrong in our life. The story of Job is pain was inflicted on him for a purpose. Now we know that that was looking to the future when a man would go to the cross, not because of anything he had done wrong, but pain was inflicted on him at the hand of God. Why? In both cases, it was God's plan. Let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 5. Now, he who has made us and prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us the Spirit as a pledge or a down payment on the fulfillment of his promise. He who made us and prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us his Spirit. The things that happen in our life, both before and after we accept Christ, we know are not coincidence, right? It's not that God is there watching us live our life to the best of our ability. There are things that I can do perhaps outside of his will. There are things that I can do to grieve his Spirit. But at the same time, we also admit that God is all-powerful. He has full knowledge of everything that will happen. And as we were singing about, the end of the story is by his design. When the Lord comes, how the Lord comes, and what the Lord does when he returns is the plan of God. The same is true in our life. Whether it's tragedy, whether it's joy, whether it's against him, whether it's for him, this is the plan of God. He made us and prepared us for this very purpose. He is God, and he gave us his Spirit as a pledge. Now, that sounds very positive and very nice, right? all of these things that God has done for us. How do you reconcile the God of Job and the God of 2 Corinthians? That's what we're going to look at in the life of Joseph. But to think about it a little further, that reconciliation is the fact that God has invested his own spirit into us, thereby proving that he has made us and prepared us for a purpose of his own. The good things that happen, the bad things that happen, purposed. When we walk away, when we're in step with him, it's in his control. The evidence of this is in what the Spirit does. What does the Spirit do? And we've heard this in a few messages before. To quickly recap, in Genesis 1 and 2, we find that the Spirit was there in the creation of the world. 2 Peter 1 and 21, the Spirit is the source of all prophecy. Hebrews 9 and 14, when Christ offered himself as a sacrifice, he did so through the Spirit. John 16, 8, the Spirit convicts men of sin, righteousness, and judgment. 1 Corinthians 6, 19, the Spirit indwells the believer. Ephesians 4 and 30, the Spirit seals and marks the believer. Titus 3, 5, he regenerates and transforms the believer. 2 Corinthians 5, 17, he renews the believer. 1 Corinthians 12 and 13, he spiritually transforms all believers into one body in Christ. Acts 8, 39, he performs miracles. Acts 1 and 2, he instructs believers. John 14, 26, he teaches believers all things. Romans 8, 14, he leads believers. Romans 8, 26, he intercedes on our behalf before God. John 14, 16, he counsels and helps believers. 2 Corinthians 5, 5, he's a guarantee of the promise of God. 1 Corinthians 12, 7, he gives gifts for the working of the believer. So think about the believer from the moment he believes to the time of his meeting God. Through that story, what's left for him to do? God is the one who presented the story to us. God is the one who convicted me of my sins so that I would believe. God is the one that cleansed me, washed me, brought me into his own family, brought me into the body of believers, taught me all things about himself, and gave me the power to work for him on this earth. So now we step back and look at the story of Job. God was involved. That's who he is. He doesn't change. He wasn't different today than he was before. He was there in the life of Job, the good and the bad. Job was the richest man. When you read about his morality and uprightness, I think you could say he would have been the best man alive today. There's two views of the Bible, especially of the Old Testament. Well, there's many, but there's two that are opposed to each other. One is that the Old Testament is mostly just a history of God and his people. The other is that of allegory. Not that the stories are not true and accurate, but there are things we are told and there are things we are not told. And the way that that is done paints a picture that God wanted us to understand. You know, often we have life experiences, and as we relate these to people, there's typically a lesson involved. I'm not telling you the story to tell you the fact of what happened in my life. I'm telling you the story of something that actually happened in a way that it provides a lesson. When we look at Job, when we look at the life of Joseph, which we're about to do right now, there are things that are told and things that are not told to us. We don't have all the details. We don't have all the commentary. Why is that? Genesis chapter 37. We're going to look at the life of Joseph. There's a lot here we're going to skip. It's really just the perspective of him and what he goes through. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 2. Joseph, when he was 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. The boy was with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now, this is one example where we find, what is that there for? Doesn't say anything that happened as a result of it, it just says it. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a multicolored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than all the other brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. I always like to point these out. In the notes, it's referenced that in verse 5, the word hate there is a play on words. The word hate and Joseph are the same. So when it says that they hated him, you could say they Josephed him even more. There's a sense of who he was the thing that caused that hatred. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have dreamed. We were binding sheaves in the field, and my sheaf got up and stood upright and remained standing. Your sheaves stood all around my sheaf and bowed down." His brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule and govern us as your subjects?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. But Joseph dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers. He said, "See here, I have again dreamed a dream. And lo, 11 stars and the sun and the moon bowed down to me." He told it to his father as well as to his brothers. His father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow down to the ground before you?" Joseph's brothers were envious and jealous of him, but his father kept the words in his mind. His brothers went to pasture their flocks near Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing at Shechem? Come, and I will send them to you." And he said, "Here I am." Jacob said to him, "Go and see whether everything is all right with your brothers and all right with the flock. Then bring word back to me." So he sent him from Hebron Valley, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found Joseph and saw he was wandering around and had lost his way. The man asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing their flocks." The man said, "They have moved on from this place. I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Again, that last little account, why is that there? Was that an important historical fact given all the other details that are missing? One interesting thing too, this is a subject for another time, but worth investigation, the place of Shechem. We're reading in Genesis chapter 37. If you look at Genesis chapter 36, there's an interesting story there. If you look at Genesis chapter 38, there's an interesting story there. Again, somewhat out of the flow of the story. So why did God put those there? All the events related to the things that happened at Shechem, from Abraham's great-grandfather all the way up through the captivity. So Joseph has these dreams. No one appreciates them. One of the things we're not told in this part here is what is the reaction that Joseph has to all of this. They didn't like the first dream, but he tells them the second dream anyway. And the second time he tells his brothers and his parents. Jacob has the same response. Why are you telling us this? But there was something about Jacob where he kept it in his mind to think about. Why is he having these dreams? The way I view this in the life of Joseph is quite literally, this was his vision for his life. Now, you could look at a vision in two ways. You could look at a vision as something that is imparted on you, something that will portend about what will happen in the future. You could also look at a vision as to a plan that you have. What direction are you headed in? What direction are you going? As we think about it from the life of the believer, God imparts the vision. Even when it doesn't make sense, even when it's not pleasant, God imparts the vision. If we go down to verse 36 of chapter 37, we see that Joseph, meanwhile in Egypt, the Midianites sold Joseph to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So he's now a slave in Egypt. The interesting thing about the concept of a slave is there is a New Testament parallel that explains to us that before we were believers, we were slaves, and after we were believers, we're slaves. When you look at the story of Job, you have a man who was upright, who had everything. He was the richest man in the East. but he still did not have the power or the ability to withhold against the prince of this world at this time. Joseph had all things. He was the favorite of his father. They were a very rich family. And he finds himself as a slave in Egypt. Chapter 39, verse 2. If that was the end of the story, we might see that as a tragedy. There's more tragedy to follow, but we do have some commentary here. The Lord, 39 and 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful and prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper, succeed in his hand. So Joseph pleased Potiphar and found favor in his sight, and he served him as his personal servant. He made Joseph overseer over his house, and he put all that he owned in Joseph's charge. It happened from that time that he made Joseph overseer in his house over all that he owned, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house because of Joseph. So the Lord's blessing was on everything that Potiphar owned in the house and in the field. You know, I'm going to extend from one to two things about the life of a Christian. Answering the question of why is there suffering in this world. The other is what we show to the world of who God is through our own life. I would argue that in the New Testament, there's a stronger case for that as a testimony to God than there is of preaching the gospel. And I'm not sure that they're different. One is words, and one is action. What we find here is that even as a slave in Egypt, coming from where he came from, God's purpose for Joseph was that he was going to prosper. Regardless of his position. So much so that it became evident to the people around him, God has blessed him. Here, more responsibility. God has blessed you. Oh, good things happen. That's what Israel was meant to be to the world. To show the world who God was by how good of a life that they lived. That he prospered and blessed them with all things. We want to know more about this God. Down to verse 20. So Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. That didn't last long. Now again, is this the failure of God? It was God's purpose for Joseph that he would have success and prosper. It was God's power through Joseph that made that evident to Pharaoh. So how did he end up in prison? Was it a failure on God's part? Was it a failure on Joseph's part? No, Joseph had done nothing wrong. It's all part of God's plan. The purpose didn't change. Now, again, if we end the story here, well, it failed. God tried, right? He couldn't save him from his brothers. He got sold into slavery. He tried to give him a good life. He couldn't even save him from Potiphar's wife. So often I think we think that when these things happen, well, that's the end, right? Life's over. There is a journey to life. God has purposed that journey. There's ups and downs. What happens next has nothing to do with what happened before, other than what we take away from the experience. God can turn it around very quickly. And the significant thing is that he is in control. So it's difficult, even though this is the natural response, and it's hard to think, I'm not sure always how to fix this in my head. But it's difficult to think that I'm going to get upset by something that happened in my life when we've already seen I don't have that power. God had the knowledge. God had the plan. I'm here for a reason. This is what Job wrestled with his friends. Why is this happening to me? What could I have done differently to avoid this? Now, Job was confident. I've done nothing wrong. But I still can't answer the question. Go over to chapter 40 of Genesis and verse 14. Only think of me when it goes well and show me kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For in fact, I was taken or stolen from the land of the Hebrews by force. And even here I have done nothing for which they should put me in the dungeon. Again, we don't have much on Joseph's mindset, but we see here that at least he understood, obviously, that he shouldn't have been here. He had been wronged, and he wanted to get out. But what we find was that even though he makes mention of this, no criticism of him asking of this, it wasn't time. It wasn't in God's plan at that time that he would come out of prison. Down to chapter 41 and verse 12. Now, there was with us a young man, a Hebrew, servant to the captain of the guard, and we told him and he interpreted our dreams for us, to each man according to the significance of his own dream. And just as he interpreted for us, so it happened, I was restored to my office, and the baker was hanged. Then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon. Again, the testimony of Joseph to these people. Now, it didn't reap the benefit that God had intended until it was time. But Joseph established himself not only as a good man, a moral man, an upright man, but he evidenced the power of God to others. And that's the thing that God used to get him out of the dungeon. It was only then, when God decided, that's when Pharaoh sent for him. And again, you could say, what a coincidence that they just happened to remember that, right? Well, what was the coincidence? Pharaoh had a dream that he couldn't interpret. These guys remembered, oh yeah, this guy interpreted my dream. Well, where do you think that dream came from that Pharaoh had? Chapter 41 and verse 38. So Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this, in whom is the divine spirit of God? The testimony that Joseph has, not about himself as a believer, oh, that guy's a good Christian man, let's give him this role. The testimony was about how good God is. Verse 46, we find he was 13 years in Egypt. And again, go down to chapter 41 and verse 50. We have an interesting way that God provides us the commentary of Joseph's understanding of this situation. Now, two sons were born to Joseph. Joseph named the firstborn son Manasseh, meaning causing to forget, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and hardship and all the sorrow of my father's household. He named the second son Ephraim, fruitfulness, for God has caused me to be fruitful and very successful in the land of my suffering. So we find, okay, well, Joseph, what were you thinking about this situation? You had these dreams, you told your brothers, they sold you off after they decided not to kill you. You ended up as a slave, you had a position, you end up in a dungeon. Finally, God brings you out of that dungeon, and now you're one of the most powerful men in Egypt. And he says, the place where I am today in this life, how do I feel about it? God has made me forget the bad things. And he's given me this place of blessing and plenty. Genesis chapter 42 and verse 8. Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams he had dreamed about them. It's starting to happen. God had a plan for Joseph. He had a vision of what was going to happen in his life. And just now it's starting to happen. Down to verse 21. And they said to one another, truly we are guilty regarding our brother because we saw the distress and anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us to let him go, yet we would not listen. So this distress and anguish has come on us. Reuben answered, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Now the accounting for his blood is required. Reuben knew that there was the right thing to do was not to do what they did to Joseph. So again, did someone make a mistake here? Was someone wrong in what actually transpired? Was God's purpose for Joseph that he wasn't supposed to be sold into slavery? And these men kind of changed God's path? Or was it meant to happen exactly as it did? Where they were wrong in selling him into slavery, but it was still God's plan. But we find here that Joseph had pleaded with them, "Do not do this to me." In other words, we go back to the beginning and say, Joseph had these dreams. His brothers got mad. He told them the second one anyway. Oh, well, maybe Joseph had some idea of what God was doing in his life. No, he didn't. He didn't want to do this. He didn't want to be a slave. Now, if you had told him, but this is what will happen, maybe he would have assented. But that's not how God did it. God didn't tell him, I'm going to sell you into slavery, but don't worry about it. It'll end up for good, not just for you, but the whole nation, my people. At that time, Joseph did not want to be a slave. Was he struggling against God's will? Chapter 43 and verse 1. Now the famine was very severe in the land, and it happened that when the families of Jacob's son had finished eating all the grain which they had, their father said, "Go, buy us a little food in Egypt." Now, again, the story here is that God put Joseph in a position in Egypt for two reasons. One, because there was going to be great famine. And so Joseph saves the whole area by storing up the food, and then everyone in the famine years has food to eat. One of the people that benefits from that is Jacob, Israel. They don't die. They had gotten to the very end of the food, and that's when they go down to Egypt. And you could say, well, isn't that nice? God had this plan for Joseph, that he was going to save them. Because if Jacob and his family dies, we don't have Israel. But was that a mistake of God? Oops, didn't see that one coming. Now I got to fix it, right? But it's even better than that. Where'd the famine come from? Joseph wasn't a response to something that happened that God had to figure out what's the plan here. Famine's coming. Where'd the famine come from? Down to chapter 45 and verse 1. Joseph could not control himself in front of those who had attended him. He called out, "Have everyone leave me." So no one stood there when Joseph revealed himself to his brothers. Joseph wept aloud, and the Egyptians heard it. The household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers were speechless, for they were stunned and dismayed in Joseph's presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Come closer to me." And they approached him and said, "I am Joseph, your brother, who you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me ahead of you to save life and preserve our family." Right? In the beginning, "Do not sell me into slavery." Now he's telling him, "Don't worry about it. It was God's plan. It had to happen that way. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still five more. There will be no plowing or harvesting. God sent me ahead of you to preserve you for a remnant on the earth and to keep you alive by a great escape. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. Then he made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land." Not only did God purpose Joseph to go down into Egypt exactly the way that he did, not only does Joseph tell them, "Look, don't worry about it, this was God's plan," but it was God who sent him through them. The brothers didn't send him by mistake. God didn't have to course correct to figure out, well, how do I do this? That's not how I wanted him to get there. It was God. When they sold him into slavery, when they put him in the, that was God. It was his plan. Joseph says it right here. Down to verse 25. "So they went up from Egypt, came into the land of Jacob to their father, and they said to him, 'Joseph is alive, and indeed he is ruler over all the land of Egypt.' But Jacob was stunned, and his heart almost stopped beating because he did not believe them. When they told him everything that Joseph had said, when he saw the wagons which Joseph had sent, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, 'It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" Remember, when Joseph told him the dream, he kept that in his mind. What is this dream about? After he rebuked him, but what is this dream about? Well, it took a long time, but he finally saw it. Down to chapter 46 and verse 2. God spoke to Israel in visions. "Jacob, Jacob," and he said, "Here I am." And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. I will surely bring you up again and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes at the time of your death." So it wasn't just that Joseph sent them down there because there was a famine and, you know, Jacob and his family could survive, they would eventually become Israel. Psalm 105, again, looking for God's commentary on the situation. And luckily we have a little bit of that. This will be our last passage here. Psalm 105, verse 15. "Do not touch my appointed ones, do my prophets no harm. He called for a famine upon the land." God called for that famine. "He cut off every source of bread. He sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet they hurt with shackles. He was put in chains of iron. Till the time of his word came true, the word of the Lord tested and refined him." It's not that God was reacting to the situation that the brothers had done, that Potiphar's wife has done. That experience was exactly what Joseph needed because God said so. Not just to elevate him to the point where he could save them from the famine, but because as Joseph as a person, he was going to be tested and refined by God in that experience. "The king sent and released him, the rulers of the people, and set him free. He made Joseph lord of the house, ruler of his possessions, to imprison his princes at will, that he might teach his elders wisdom. Israel also came into Egypt. Thus Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. There the Lord greatly increased his people and made them more powerful than their enemies." The complexity of this situation is vast. God is concerned about the life of a man, testing and refining him, of bringing him blessing, taking away his suffering, the suffering that he had imposed on him. There's saving the future nation of Israel from this famine that was going to occur, but it was the famine that God called for. And then it's that in Egypt, this is where God decided that his nation would be born, and they would become great, and they would become more powerful than their enemies, in the place where they also were slaves. And the story goes on. Now, as we take that for us, in the life of Job, in the life of Joseph, why do they have to go through these things? Yeah, sometimes we don't know. And sometimes in that moment, no, I don't want to go into slavery. And then we find out later on, that's how it was meant to be. And not only was that not a mistake that that's what happened, but it was that experience that God has used in my life to make me who I am today. To be a testimony to the world, not only of what God did for me, but who God is himself and what he can do for everyone. And as we think about this in the sense of suffering, as we think of this in the sense of a testimony, there is nothing that escapes God's power, his plan, or anything that he has for this world, up until the point, and even including after, his return and the judgment that will come. It's all his. Our Father, we just give thanks for your word, that we can have an understanding of your mind, of what you are doing in this world, what you are doing in our lives, that you have empowered us with your own spirit. There is nothing we have done. Salvation is from you. Redemption is from you. The cleansing is from you. The power to do work for you is from you. The limitation in our life is always what is in our mind of what we can do. But there is nothing. Coming to a constant revelation that this is the most important thing for us to understand. That you have provided it all. That there is a plan for everyone in every moment. Even when it seems like suffering. Even when it seems like pain. There is a purpose to it. And there is always a future glory, because you desire what is good for us. We ask this in his precious name. Amen.